Canada has for the past year been conducting a parliamentary inquiry into the status of sex workers and what the best response in laws and services to their needs would be. In the U.S., the city of Berkeley in California last year voted on a ballot measure that sought to place sex work at the bottom of law enforcement priorities. Though it was defeated, sex worker organizers said it was an important opportunity for public dialogue and education. In Washington, D.C., local sex workers and organizations are fighting new laws that will increase the criminalization of sex workers. All efforts are well summarized in the slogan of the DMSC of India, "We eat by our labor, so we want labor rights." Elena, a sex worker activist in Australia, is optimistic that those rights are within the grasp of sex workers.
As sex workers, we share intimate relations with people who are our clients, our customers. Our skills are amazing. We debate, negotiate interpersonal relations and intimacy. Our negotiation skills, our time management skills, our budgeting skills, our ability to live in an anti-sex work community and maintain honesty, dignity, respect and safety in our work. We and millions of women, transgender and male sex workers across the globe do this all day, every day. And by joining here together, we can also see that if we put these amazing, complex skills that we use in sex work, if we can put these skills to use in solidarity in a sex worker movement, we cannot be beaten.
That's it for Sprouts. Our contributor this week was Darby Hickey of the DC Radio Co-op. You heard music from Demfra, City High, Donna Summers, Fisher Spooner, and Destiny's Child. Sprouts is distributed and coordinated by Pacifica Radio Network, thanks to Jim Bennett and Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. Our air traffic controller is Ursula Rudenberg. You can find us on the web at sproutsradio.org. I'm Selena Masuta. See you next week on Sprouts.
One time.
It's right. In the middle, with a shower and it's cold light. It goes wherever it wants to. Don't try to predict it. Then you'd offend it. To surprise. Nature is ancient, but surprises us all. Nature is ancient, but surprises us all.
Coming up next on 101.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, it's Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Stay tuned.
All I am is just a housewife. Nothing special, nothing great. What I do is kind of boring. If you'd rather, it can wait. All I am is someone's mother. All I am is someone's wife. All of which seems unimportant. All it is just my life. Do the laundry, wash the dishes, take the dog out, clean the house, shop for groceries, look for specials. God, it sounds so Mickey Mouse. Drop the kids off, pick the shirts off, try to lose weight, try again. Keep the troops fed, pick their things up, lose your patience, count to 10. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
All I am is just a housewife, just a housewife, nothing great. What I do is out of fashion,
what I feel is
out of date.
All I am is someone's mother.
Right away, I'm not too bright.
What I do is
unfulfilling.
So the TV talk shows tell me every night.
I don't mean to complain at all, but they make you feel like the truth be told when you're just a wife,
just a housewife.
Nowadays, all the magazines make a bunch of memes out of family life. You're a whiz if you go to work, but you're just a jerk if you say you won't.
Just a housewife.
Women's lips that they think it's fine if the choice is mine.
But you know they don't. What I do, what I choose to do, may be dumb to you, but it's not to me. Is it dumb that they need me there? Is it dumb to care?
I do, you see.
And that means, did you ever think, really stop and think, what a job it was? Doing all the things that a housewife does.
I'm afraid it's unimpressive.
All I am is someone's mother.
Nothing special.
What I do is unexciting.
Kinda love.
Take the kids here, take the kids there. I don't mean to complain at all.
All I am is
busy, busy.
Everything. All I am is
like my mother.
All I am is.
Just a housewife.
And welcome to Bathurst Spears Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris. This is Free Radio, as mentioned before, and you're also listening to www.freakradio.org. The call-in number for this show, which is a two-hour civil rights discussion, or actually discussion of various issues, but I'd like to focus on local civil rights and local politics, is 427-3772, area code 831, in case you're out of the area. And you can also jump on the chat room, which it looks like it's open, at least open from this end, at www.pagesincolor, all one word, all small letters, .com. And I don't have as much prepared for today as I'd hoped, because it was a little difficult lining up the tapes. There was an eventful city council meeting, and not just because I was arrested there, which is one of the things that happened, but because of the kinds of items that appeared on the council agenda and the votes that were taken and the kind of faces the city council members revealed in that discussion. I haven't been able to watch the whole thing since part of it I was being arrested for, and the rest of it I was banned from, and I've just gotten access to the videotape. So actually, hopefully, when I return on Sunday, when I do a longer show from 9:30 to 1 in the afternoon, 9:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., I can give a more detailed description of that council session, some of the interesting things or depressing things that came out of it, and at least get some of my opinions on the subject, and perhaps I can get some of yours. I do want to give a brief account of what happened, just because I know regular listeners have asked me to. And I've also already posted a brief account on the Indie Media website, www.santacruz.indymedia, indymedia.org. So there's a place to go if you want to check out what I've already written about it, which is brief because I'm actually facing a court case. I've been charged by the police department through Mayor Rotkin. Actually, the police department has carried out a citizen's arrest by Mayor Rotkin for the misdemeanor offense of disrupting a city council meeting. And this is the first time I ever recall being violently arrested in Santa Cruz. I've been arrested probably a couple dozen times. Never been convicted of any kind of misdemeanor. And the charges are usually dropped because the arrests are usually bogus or concern laws that shouldn't be on the books to begin with and that we're trying to eliminate, or that expose city council or other practices of other people in authority that they don't want to essentially go into in court. This charge of disrupting a council meeting is one that has previously been used against me and actually is the subject of a lawsuit. There's never been a case taken to trial involving me for disrupting a council meeting, though I have been charged. This would be the fourth time I've been charged with that in 16 years, something like that. Maybe 17 years. I think there was a charge way back in 1988 when, again, we were trying to secure oral communications time for issues the city council did not want to address. And they were using stratagems and mechanisms, cutting back on public comment time, and we were simply trying to reclaim the public comment time that had traditionally been allowed. And because we did that, we were arrested and taken out of the chambers, taken to jail, in fact, and charged. And that case was dropped, as have the other cases I've been charged with. But this is the first time I've actually ever been violently arrested. And I'm usually often critical of how Santa Cruz police enforce bad laws, or the fact that they enforce them at all, but also in different occasions how they've treated certain people in custody, and indeed how people have died, like Happy John Dine. But I've never been physically abused myself until Tuesday, at least not by the Santa Cruz police. And that was quite a little incident. Unfortunately, I don't know that there's any video of it, because this wasn't a staged media event. It probably should have been, but it wasn't. It was a situation where I was challenging the city council to allow me to speak for the same 2 minutes that everyone else was being allowed to speak on an item number. I have it here. 13.1, which had to do with a motion to authorize, essentially it was a sort of an anti-union motion by the staff, which passed 4-3 with Rotkin cheering it on, eventually, after I'd left, to let Yahtzee, which is one of the unions in town, to essentially terminate their contract with a letter, or to notify them their contract had been terminated. Essentially, it docked them of some of their power in the negotiations that they're engaged in. And I'm hoping to have a union person on Sunday to discuss the significance of that issue. My issue, of course, is really more broadly the rights of disadvantaged minorities, people who the city council doesn't like, doesn't want to hear from, doesn't want to address their issues, to be able to have fair speaking time and get access to the record, if not the community, if not, hopefully, ultimately, the law, because the city council makes the local law, through fair and open public process. And you've heard me talk a lot about the Brown Act, which is the state law that requires the city council to publish its agendas, to allow people to speak, not to ban them from public meetings. I read today, for example, about the There's some indie media discussion about banning some people from meetings of political groups. City council and public meetings customarily can't ban people, and particularly under meetings of legislative bodies can't ban members of the public, even if you don't like them, which I think, frankly, is a very good thing. I think we'd be in pretty bad shape. I think we're in bad enough shape as it is. We'd be in much worse shape if the authorities in power were allowed to ban people on thin pretexts. In fact, they actually are allowed to do that, but they have to create more elaborate pretexts, and that is what city councils do when they are hearing from people that they don't really want to hear from on a regular basis. And of course, I'm one of those people. The arrest situation, let me sort of get to it briefly because I'm going to hopefully explore it in some more detail and again some more of the issues on Sunday when I come back and have a longer period of time to talk. And also maybe even a witness. There were a couple of witnesses to this arrest. I recorded it as well, but the lieutenant who arrested me, Lieutenant Steve Clark, confiscated the audio tape. I informed him I was a Free Radio Santa Cruz broadcaster. I'm also a writer for Street Spirit newspaper. I'm a reporter, as well as being a citizen, as well as being a member of the community. And such tapes have never been confiscated before at any prior city council arrest. This was an action taken by Lieutenant Clark, and it may be that one of the reasons he took that action was to... What would I say? I think he may have been somewhat embarrassed about his behavior because he was the arresting officer. Anyway, what happened was I had been speaking on... I pulled two consent agenda items off the afternoon session of the Santa Cruz City Council on Tuesday afternoon and spoke about them briefly. Now, the City Council has adopted a new rule, which I think is designed specifically to deal with myself and a few other people who they want to discourage from coming to council. We pull several consent agenda items and talk on them, and often Mayor Rotkin has complained that this takes up so much time that it just interferes with the normal business. In fact, of course, if you examine the record, what takes up the time is the amount of time the City Council spends trying to refute what some of us say and then debate and discuss and go on in their lengthy fashion about it. That's what takes up the time. But, of course, the City Council members are not interested in limiting their own time, which could be done and is done at the federal level. House representatives, you get a certain amount of time to speak. Could do the same thing at City Council. Or they could limit time on an item that they have to speak, which would facilitate the process. But no, their solution is to cut back the public time, and specifically what they did here on these consent agenda items, they had at one point, in order to avoid listening to me speak on these agenda items, they would do various things. First, they would put the agenda items at the end of the meeting. Then, when the lawsuit that I had filed against them 3 years ago for taking me out of city council chambers when I raised my arm in a silent, "you're acting like a bunch of fascists" mock Nazi salute to them after they had not let another person speak at the mic, a peace activist named Susan Zeman, that lawsuit, my lawsuit against them, they never had any charges that stood up against me, as I've mentioned before, wound its way back into the federal court, where it now will be going to trial in February of 2006, unless it's settled out of court. And so they're becoming a bit more sensitive to the fact that they have to be somewhat accountable for their behavior. So their practice of, let's say, putting an item at the very end of the agenda, my items only, looks pretty discriminatory. So they stopped doing that. Then they started giving me less amounts of time to speak than other people. That didn't look particularly good either on the record, so they stopped doing that. So Mayor Rotkin came up with this plan to limit all people's speech on all consent agenda items to 5 minutes, which I've talked to you, the listening audience. I've spoken about this on the air before. And what happened here was that the 5 minutes involved, of course, it has a nice kind of ring when you're putting it together. Ed Porter, I think, and Mayor Rotkin put this together. There are often, 10 to 20 consent agenda items, and some of them, most of them get passed without anybody caring one way or the other, or discussing them, and perhaps they shouldn't be. Perhaps they should be more closely examined. But usually, if I go to a council meeting, I pull one or two or three of them. And on this occasion, as I said, I pulled two, and I spoke for 2 minutes. And then the third item came up involving housing, and I spent another minute and a half talking about that, all of which proceeded. Then this item on the union activity went on, the attempt to essentially an anti-union measure by Rotkin. Actually, I'm not sure if he's the person who specifically introduced it. As I said, I need more time to really look into that. But it came up, and so I thought about it for a bit, and I thought, you know, I had no way really of knowing, because I hadn't heard the kinds of discussions that were going on at the council and the previous anti-union votes that had happened. There were a couple of those, at least one of those. That made me decide, I really want to talk on this item. At that point, as Rotkin later said, I had, quote, used up my 5 minutes, the idea that everybody has only 5 minutes to talk on any and all consent agenda items as a bunch. And I realized that that was not, which was a violation of the First Amendment, of course, the freedom of speech, the right to speak. It's also a violation, I think, of the Brown Act, which allows the public to speak at California public legislative meetings, of which this is one, and requires them to provide speaking time for the public on each item. Now, the idea that suddenly you are stopping a person from speaking on one item because he spoke on another item, simply, I realized, doesn't wash. It's not fair. It doesn't afford the public the opportunity that they need. Even members of the public who come in and fairly want to abide by these rather constricting rules that I said were designed to silence a particular minority of people can't do so. Well, if they will have to censor themselves to do so if something else comes up on the agenda that they hadn't anticipated. And often when you come to a city council meeting, you don't know which items you're going to speak on. You can't really write them out in advance. You have to sort of listen to the debate and discussion. You'll kind of stand up and you'll join the discussion. So this is what I did. I stood in line for this item. I got involved. And I was told by Mayor Rotkin I couldn't speak. And I realized he was going to have me arrested if I continued to be there. But I felt so strongly about it that I thought, okay, I'll be arrested again. That's fine, to make this issue clear and plain. And that's not always the best thing to do, by the way, folks. You can make an issue clear and plain without getting arrested. I don't recommend getting arrested as a matter of course. There are better forums to use than the courts or an empty jail cell where you're sitting alone, or a crowded jail cell where you're sitting with a bunch of drunks or other folks who are being held there for different reasons. But in this situation, I, for one reason or another, decided to make a stand. And it was not an extremely well-thought-out position, I've got to tell you, in terms of media. There was no media there. Indy Media in the past had done an excellent job of covering demonstrations and protests at city council if they're advised in advance. And I really didn't think I was going to be getting into any of this when it happened. So it just happened. And Rotkin, of course, ordered the cameras turned off, so that no one could see what went on. And I anticipated that I would be told, okay, you're under arrest, you have to leave the chambers, and I would go outside, probably be taken, maybe to, be given a cite and release, as they say, told not to come back for the duration of the council session, and then have to deal with it in court, where it would probably, as all these other charges have been, be dismissed. And if it wouldn't be dismissed, then we'd continue raising the issue there. Well, what happened instead was Lieutenant Clark, who was in the back room along with the chief of police and several other high-ranking police officials, Deputy Chief Vogel, I think, was there too, and perhaps Deputy Chief Sapone. There was an item concerning parties coming up, more restrictions on landlords and more penalties for loud parties and things of that sort. And so they were there perhaps for that purpose. Clark, sort of in a menacing tone, said to me, "Leave the chambers, Robert. It's time for you to leave the chambers." And I turned to him and I said, "Lieutenant Clark, am I under arrest?" And he then took my left hand and began twisting it behind my back. And I said, "Lieutenant Clark, am I under arrest? I'll be happy to leave if you tell me I'm under arrest." He continued to say, "You have a choice, Robert. You can leave the chambers." And I said, "Am I under arrest? And what is the charge?" And I kept repeating this more and more loudly because he began to cause me some serious pain. And at that point, after about a minute, and maybe a minute and a half, it seemed, of course, it could have been longer. I didn't, and it could have been shorter, because I don't, when subjectively, when you're in that situation, you can't really, you know, who knows how long it was. And I was tape recording it, but of course my tape recording is now in the possession of Lieutenant Clark. He finally, I think it was Deputy Chief Vogel, told me, the mayor has given a made a citizen's arrest. And I said, okay. And we went outside. And there was more threatening that happened to Lieutenant Clark, who was very angry with me for not leaving the chambers. He referred to past incidents he'd had with me, and he felt he'd been victimized by one of the lawsuits that I filed for a... It was probably one of the city council arrests. He wasn't clear. And he went on angrily denouncing me and kind of menacing me. And this was very quiet off to the side. And, of course, it wasn't witnessed by anyone but me. The cuffs were put on very tight as I was escorted to the vehicle. I was wearing a pair of shorts, and I informed him that the shorts were coming off. And, of course, Clark, in response to this, instead of letting me hold on to my shorts and pull them up, intensified a pain compliance hold that he had again resumed on me, and they fell to my ankles. So anyone with a camera nearby would have seen a rather humiliating situation. It was a nasty arrest, and it was a violent arrest, and it was one which I've never experienced before. My left wrist is still tender. My fingers are numb. I've been to a doctor about it. And who knows where it's going to lead, except that it should certainly lead, I'm tempted to say, to retraining the police department. But I think that an article is going to be written about it for Street Spirit, and I don't know what's going to, you know, one can only guess what's going to come. I don't want to say lawsuits are going to be filed when they're not, because to file a lawsuit you need an attorney, and you know, you need some capital to back you, so who knows whether that's going to happen. But I think it was really a shocking demonstration of power and illegitimate force by the police department. And that the political context in which it happened, as I've said, is something I'll discuss when I come back on Sunday, because hopefully I'll have a better sense of the progress of the city council meeting and what happened there. My concern, again, is the right of the public to have access to really the public, because it is the public is hopefully in the real legislative process is the public discussing with itself what to do about various community problems. Now, the city council is the representative body by which through which these things are supposed to happen. But I think, as we've seen, I think we have a rather nasty majority on the city council now. Matthews, Rotkin, Coonerty, and Riley. Pretty clear majority there on a lot of these issues. That's how the vote came down on Tuesday. And one of the advantages of the city council meeting is that's a place where people can, if they want, tune in through community TV to hear a real discussion both of the council members and that limited amount of access that the general public has. And I'd like to see that access returned. I'd like to see it restored. And I don't know that that's going to happen in my lifetime. And it's really got me shaking my head and rubbing my wrist. But that's kind of a brief discussion of what happened. Not as brief as I'd hoped. That's 25 minutes. Sorry about that. Let's get a little music, and we'll move on to something else. If anybody has any comments or questions or thoughts or want to talk about your own experiences with the police or at city council or reflections on the First Amendment or the Brown Act, please feel free to call in 427-3772.
My father was a farmer, and I his only daughter. I took up with an old good mill working man from Massachusetts, but died from too much whiskey and leaves me these three faces to feed. Millwork ain't easy, millwork ain't hard. Millwork most often is a goddamn awful boring job, and I'm waiting for a daydream to take me through the morning, put me in my coffee break, where I can have my sandwich and remember. And it's me and my machine for the rest of the morning, for the rest of the afternoon, and the rest of my life. To the days back on the farm, and I can see my father smiling at me, swinging on his arm, and I can hear my granddad's stories of the storms on all Mercury, vessels and cargoes, fortunes and sailors' lives were lost. It's my life has been wasted, and I have been a fool to let this manufacturer use my body for a tool. I get to ride home in the evening, staring at my hands, swearing by my sorrow that a young girl ought to stand a better chance. And may I work this mill just as long as I am able, and never meet the man whose name is on the label. It's me and my machine for the rest of the morning, for the rest of the afternoon gone, and the rest of my life.
And that was another selection from Working, Studs Terkel Musical, which you are going to be able to hear more selections from later in this show. Again, you're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org. So, going to play a little bit more music while I queue up a few tapes, but actually I think what I'll do is take this call first. Hello, can you hear me? Hello?
Robert?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Hey, yeah, this is Ed. I tuned in about 5 minutes ago and you were arrested, you were saying?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I just heard the same old thing I've heard again. It's just like, you know, we live in a police state, and it's time for me to wake up. I know I have no rights. You know, I've known this for a while. Down Felker and selective law enforcement, and where vigilantism is approved by one big old fat pig and a skinny little freak of nature white pig. And, you know, I found out, you know, this is my belief is this is shithole America. And we best know it, you know, and it's a police state, and the thugs are in charge, and they're not all bad. I come into contact with sheriff's officers at times through my line of work. There's decent people. There's also serious, bad, bad sheriffs. I've come in contact with Santa Cruz police. I'm thinking there's a good guy. I don't know, you know, I have doubt. They're in charge, man. They're in control, and the sheep us sheep, we don't know what the hell to do. We have no Bill of Rights anymore, and we're so stupid, we think we do. And I think we're just a bunch of cowering sheep. One time, Jerry Spence wrote in a book that man has domesticated, you know, the chicken from the wild hen and blah, 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 and the cow from the wildebeest, and man has domesticated ourselves. And the rebels that don't cooperate, they're locked up in prison, more than 2 million of them now, I believe. And this is the way it is, and us sheep will act around like stupid, dumb, fat, dumb, and happy idiots, and we don't even know what fucking deal's going on, man. We're such cowards. We've been bred into such cowards that, you know, it's sickening. Are you there?
Oh, yeah. I'm bleeding away here.
Land of the free and home of the brave. It's the land of the unfree, rage slaves, stupid, damn, fucking vegetables. They go through the master school system and taught just what the fuck... You know, they want us to know what new master wants us to know.
Ed, are you still living in your vehicle?
Yes.
How,
it's time people fucking wake up and look what they did to you. You know, extreme force in their hand. This person should be fucking taken out and horsewhipped. You know, that's not an officer. That's a piece of shit.
Well, you know, I Lieutenant Clark, who's actually a lieutenant, which is kind of what really concerns me, is.
Well, the scum floats to the top.
I mean, he and I have you know, had our differences over the years. I don't think his behavior was professional. And, in fact, I think it's probably actionable. And I'm hoping that, you know, the problem is that, obviously, Lieutenant Clark probably has quite a jacket. I mean, he's been the subject of numerous complaints over the two decades I've known him and the police department. I mean, talking about him, however, today sounds a little like, you know, personal and like sour grapes because of the fact that I got the personal treatment from him.
I didn't detect that from what you had to say.
Right. I'm trying to avoid that because, frankly, as I told Lieutenant Clark, as he was sitting next to me engaging in various threatening comments, look, Lieutenant, this is not personal. I'm not trying to make you look bad before the chief or before the mayor. I needed you to tell me that I'm under arrest before I leave the chambers because... That's the only way that I felt I could assert the situation properly. I mean, you know, I don't, you know, if I were simply to leave without doing that, I think I would be succumbing to a kind of authority that would be inappropriate. I think people have a right to stay in city council chambers.
Yeah, but we don't have rights.
I know.
I know.
In effect, we don't. I mean, this kind of shows that. But the reality is we have to regain those rights. Let me put it that way.
Right.
And the way to regain them is to make it very, very clear to observers, to the court, and to force accountability by public officials and police officials that, you know, if you're gonna try to deprive someone of their rights, then you have to arrest them and you have to have a legitimate charge, you know. And that eventually, of course, is what happened. But it happened only after, I believe, unlawful force was being used. And in other words, Clark jumped the gun, and then instead of apologizing or anything of that sort, you know,
why apologize? They can get away with it.
Well, yeah.
You know, and it's condoned.
But you know,
and the other officers with that code of silence or whatever. You know, one bad apple continues to stay there.
Well, you know, there are other police officers, I think, who might act differently, and that's what you've said,
yes,
too.
It's
I
true.
Mean, I think you have some, you know, some police officers probably rather well who are.
No, I don't know any personally rather well.
Oh,
sorry, I don't.
Oh, okay.
I don't.
Right.
I see them coming, and it's like, automatic distrust. I mean, it's a Gestapo. I know this. You know, I know it by my lifestyle and the way I've lived. You know, I work full time.
Well, what
you know,
I'm saying,
I'm not getting anything for free. I'm not your average scumbag. You know, living in a vehicle. You know, doing this, doing that.
What
you
kind
know,
of work
I try to
are
do
you?
The best I can.
Ed, what kind of work are you doing these days?
I'd rather not say.
Okay.
And you know, and it's like you know, it does not matter. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been molested at my work site by a big fat piece of shit sheriff telling me. That you know, your dog's not going to stay in your, inciting and instigating, you know, causing a problem where there is no reason for a problem. I'm on county property, you know. If the truth be known, I'm at my work site. You know, I'm trying to donate my older vehicle to the Salvation Army. You know, I'm trying to do this stuff, and I have this molester molesting me, and the other one's behind my back, ready to put an elbow in the back of my neck. You know, just for me speaking up, I know how to take care of my dog. I'm a responsible owner. I know how to take care of my dog.
Well, I know that homeless people have often, people who live in their vehicles, whose houses are their homes, are often particularly vulnerable with respect to their pets, because the police can, you know, the first they can, of course, threaten to take your home.
Well, yeah, they know all the dirty tricks. They haul your home off, and then you're expected to pay $300 or whatever to get it out of a hawk.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for, you know, telling
me. So what I'm saying is, we have no rights, and it's time people wait, you know, anyway. They'll learn one day, you know. Some of us are slower than others at learning what the deal is.
Well,
I think
the more we stand together, the more chance we have of regaining our rights, and the more people like you speak up, I think the better it is. And I encourage people, if you are abused or mistreated, or even if you think there's some questionable activity by the police, one place to go is Indy Media. You can post an account of what happened to you there. It's www.santacruz.indymedia.org. And though there's some controversy about Indy Media removing some kinds of posts, I've not seen local posts about any kind of police abuse removed. I think that's a good place to go and a good thing to, you know, Indy Media, I have a lot of respect for them and that around those issues. And, Ed, I thank you for calling in. Anything more you want to say?
Yeah, I wanted to say that, you know, the old adage, nobody cares until their ox gets gored. You know, there's something wrong with the human and in human nature that, you know, it's okay for that Gestapo piece of work to do that to Robert there, and it's okay this, and pretty soon, one day, you're all going to be living in concentration camps, you know, in Patriot Act, and this, and Patriot Act 2, and this and that, and the sheep buy-in, that, you know, the buy-in of the great lie, they watch the nightly lies, and they're mesmerized and mind-controlled, and listening to Dan Rather, or whomever the new Dan Rather is, and we don't wake up or learn. It's just, I don't understand, you know. I came from, you know, I'm going to be 50 here, and I remember, you know, the 60s, and, you know, it was questioning authority, and everybody knew they were pigs and fat cats, and, you know, until proven differently. And, you know, and now it's just like absolute opposite end, you know, just cowering curs, you know, and just take whatever, and you know, it's just, I don't know. It's hopeless,
well,
Robert.
Thank you anyway.
Hey, bye.
Thanks, Ed. Yeah, I was going to say, take a look at places like Bolivia, where people have gotten together, and now there's a dual power situation there, where the masses of poor folks have challenged the, around the issues of oil and gas and just political power, and they stopped the Congress from operating. And indeed, I think the same thing can happen with other legislative bodies if they are unresponsive and abusive. And frankly, I think the city council has a lot of that. Masses of people can have an impact on that. Individuals alone maybe can act as examples, or sometimes look pretty ridiculous, or pursue their own conscience. But I think it takes numbers of people, and that certainly is true. But and that's one of the disappointing things about the Iraqi war protests so far, is we're 2 years into the Iraqi war occupation, and obviously the protests don't seem to be getting much bigger. But there is obviously a lot of unease in the community, in the country, about this issue. I found a lot of positive signs in the last week. Obviously, the 59% who want troops out is an unusually encouraging thing to read about. The Time magazine suddenly has on its cover a torturer's log, you know, from I guess from Guantanamo, or possibly from Afghanistan. I'm not sure. I think it was Guantanamo. There, even Republicans are calling for some kind of plan to get to recognize that the insurgents are not some sort of thing you can wave away. There's a whole series of indications that things are, to me, beginning to look different. The mainstream media is beginning to pay some attention to the Downing Street memo. The LA Times had a very long story on the Downing Street memo. Is a memo, for those of you who don't know, that documented what happened at Downing Street, which is the head of the Prime Minister of Britain, last in 2002 in the summer, after he kind of the folks came back and reported to Prime Minister Blair that, you know, Bush was planning, essentially, he was pushing everything for an invasion of Iraq, and they had to kind of deal with that issue. In other words, that the Iraq war was a prepped deal that had nothing to do with any anything meaningful like weapons of mass destruction about to be given out to terrorists, which was the eventual pretext used, among others. And in fact, more news stories have been coming out about a summit that Bush and Blair had 3 months before in April, and even before that summit, about plans to go to war, just ways to manipulate a war. And that is, that information is getting more and more public and is being passed on through the mainstream media, more so than I'd expected. Now, I've seen all kinds of past scandals meet with yawns and snores from the silent majority, I don't know what you'd call it, the American public, or even the activist minority that talks about it, but for some reason can't muster the numbers that we did back in February 2003 when the war was about to start. Sort of to kickstart this, I'll just read a little editorial here. This is an editorial from March, but I thought it was particularly stirring, and I'm going to read it. Before I do, let me see if I'm... Oh, yeah, another thing was the Pelosi resolution. Nancy Pelosi, otherwise wretched Democratic Party person, has introduced a second resolution. We saw the first resolution ever on the Iraqi war withdrawal, actually just asking for a plan, went down to defeat 3-1, I think it was, but at least it was voted on. Now Pelosi has a second resolution coming up in the Congress. And it's just, there is more activity, more media focus on why are we in Iraq and what are we going to do, which I think is a very positive sign. U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, writes this editorial from the Alternate Press Review, has been met with steadily strengthening resistance. Amazingly, for people who have long suffered under the curse of Western influence, even those Iraqis who are not participants in or supporters of direct attacks on the U.S.-UK occupation forces and its mercenary adjuncts have one key demand, the end of occupation and the removal of all occupation forces. The Iraqis have already had the misfortune of being used as pawns for decades in the projection of U.S. and previously U.K. military power in the region. Saddam Hussein was groomed, advised, and materially supported in his most ruthless and bloody campaigns throughout most of his career by U.S. intelligence and military forces with the direct backing of multiple U.S. presidents. In the war encouraged by U.S. and Israeli strategists between Iraq and Iran, following the overthrow of the U.S.-installed Shah in Iran, millions of people lost their lives. The populations of both countries suffered devastating destruction and immense losses that were encouraged and facilitated by U.S. ambitions to punish and weaken Iran for slipping out of U.S. control at the same time as Saddam Hussein was manipulated in order to weaken Iraq. Once Saddam Hussein was no longer a useful U.S. puppet after he took a few too many liberties with Kuwait, thinking he had the tacit support of April Glaspie and the rest of the Bush 1 regime, the Iraqi people again suffered. Over a period of weeks, more than 100,000 Iraqi troops were killed in what was at the time aptly described as a, quote, turkey shoot, by massive amounts of high-tech superpower weaponry aimed at a relatively small, defenseless country. Many thousands of Iraqi troops were massacred while fleeing after abandoning their own weapons by cowardly U.S. pilots who rained death from the air. Thousands of entrenched Iraqi troops were also buried alive in the sand by U.S. Army bulldozers with no chance to surrender offered. In cities throughout Iraq, thousands of civilians were disposed of as collateral damage in the mostly indiscriminate air attacks using so-called smart weapons wielded to instill democratic mass terror. This was during the first Iraqi war. Those who managed to survive the initial attacks faced mass illness, misery, and often shortened lives following the deliberate destruction of urban sanitation systems, water purification plants, and healthcare infrastructure, war crimes, all. A decade of U.S. orchestrated and imposed sanctions against Iraqis followed the first Gulf War massacres. As has been repeated many times, well over 500,000 children died as a result of these sanctions, to the satisfaction of U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who infamously declared that these 500,000 deaths were, quote, worth the price in a nationally televised interview. No U.S. administration spokesperson of any rank, Clinton-esque or Bush-esque, ever dissented from this Nazi-like evaluation, nor did any of the subsequent U.S. administrations during these years waver from their determination to put pressure on Saddam Hussein by tormenting and immiserating the entire population of Iraq. A policy which indirectly killed the weakest and least able to defend themselves by the tens of thousands. In order to gain enough popular support within the U.S. while failing to gain significant support around the rest of the world to launch a renewed round of massacres in Iraq, George Bush II and his entire administration, with British Prime Minister Tony Blair playing the role of cheerleader, lied repeatedly and loudly about the infamous weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We were told these weapons were a direct and immediate threat to the people of the U.S. and the U.K., except for the fact that they obviously don't exist anywhere, besides in the imaginations of the leaders, propagandists, and their lackeys in both countries. After the lies were repeated several million times by slavishly complicit mainstream media, the new invasion was launched to the cheers of successfully indoctrinated masses. Of course, it was also launched to the jeers of tens of millions who understood too well what was happening. They opposed the war and refused to be fooled, but their voices were extinguished by those same complicit mass media. Almost 2 years after the latest invasion, the ongoing daily massacres, bombings, mass kidnappings called roundups or arrests of civilians and random murders continue at the hands of U.S. forces and their mercenary adjuncts. One would never know through the U.S. mass media that since the latest invasion, at least 80% of the non-natural deaths in Iraq, this was as of March 2005, have been administered by U.S. forces. Although the exact number of deaths in a country beset by massacres, large and small, can't be known for certain, the only significant survey reported recently in the respected British medical journal, The Lancet, that was back in November of 2004, estimates that 100,000 civilians have been killed in Iraq since the U.S. invasion of 2003, mostly exterminated by U.S. aerial attacks. The U.S. Deputy Director's Operations Director for U.S.-led forces in Iraq stated in January, "If you look over the last 6 months, they have steadily escalated the barbaric nature of the attacks they have been committing." He was speaking of the Iraqi resistance, of course, and not of the horrors inflicted by the so-called precision attacks that have been launched over and over again against targets which have turned out to include women, children, and the elderly, along with plenty of civilian men. For the U.S. press, the horrific nature of these attacks doesn't exist. Millions of dead as a direct, indirect result, or indirect result of U.S.-UK manipulation, funding, arming, bombardment, massacre, and terrorism of civilians are ignored. It is up to the alternative press to remind the people of the U.S. about the true nature of the massive war crimes that have been and continue to be perpetrated in the name of Western-style democracy and the American and British peoples. Stop the massacres in Iraq. Bring the murderers home. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Sorry about that. Call or try again. 427-3772 is the number. That was an editorial in the spring 2005 issue of Alternative Press, which is at www.altpr.org. So if you have any comments on that, I'd be happy to hear them. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi. Oh, that wasn't me the first time, but I guess I'm listening right now.
Oh, go ahead.
Somebody tried to call, but I'm another caller.
Go ahead, caller.
I was listening to you read, and I just wanted to point out real quick that in about a half an hour or so at 7:30 tonight, June 16th, if this is live.
It is.
Aaron Glantz, you were talking about Iraq. Aaron Glantz, independent reporter from Free Speech Radio News, and national reporter for Pacifica Radio. He is speaking tonight at the Capitola Book Cafe, if people want to go check that out. His book just came out about a month ago. It's called How America Lost Iraq, and he went to Iraq a couple months after the invasion, a month after the fall of the big statue, and was also there during the elections just in January of 2005, and he also reported there last year from April to May.
Have you heard him speak yourself, or?
Yes, I interviewed him on the radio this afternoon.
Huh.
Actually.
Do you have any insights, or is that going to be posted, that interview?
Possibly after it's edited. But yeah, I mean, he has much insights. He was in Iraq three times, and has we talked about the resistance and the broad base of support for the resistance that exists in Iraq.
According to the Indy Media report here, which I'm not sure if you posted or if someone else did.
I'm sorry?
I'm looking at the Indy Media report on Aaron Glantz.
That's it.
He is a staunchly anti-war Pacifica radio reporter, 27 years old, spent much of the early 2003 warning of catastrophe if the U.S. invaded Iraq. I mean, I could read it, and I think I should.
There
it's coming
go.
Up at 7:30.
All right. Take care.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, this is on Indie Media for those of you who want to read it yourselves. And again, it's really an opportunity not merely to hear a guy talk about it who's been over there and who's put some time and energy into recording events, whatever you think of his perspective, but you can also talk with him, because often after these, it's a sort of a relatively informal gathering of people. I mean, he gives a speech before a bunch of people sitting in chairs at the Capitola Book Cafe. It doesn't cost anything. And you can look at his book, you can listen to his speech, and afterward you can kind of linger and mingle and chat. And it's really quite an opportunity. So I encourage people to do that. And thank you, caller, or V-man, if I can expose you, for calling in on that issue. I appreciate that. Yeah, a little bit more from this sort of to get you prepped. Aaron Glantz is a reporter for Pacific Radio and other media outlets. He's visited Iraq three times during the U.S. occupation. For a month immediately after the fall of Saddam Hussein from February to May of 2004, during the elections of January 2005. His work from Iraq has also been syndicated in newspapers around the world by the Interpress News Service. He's a founding producer of Pacifica Radio's national newscast, Free Speech Radio Now, which I believe we carry. In the course of his work, he has also reported from Egypt, Turkey, Jordan, South Korea, Indonesia, India, Vietnam, France, and Denmark. And before becoming an international reporter, he served as California State Capitol reporter for Pacifica's flagship station, KPFA, in Berkeley, where he won the California Journalism Award for radio in 2000. He's native of San Francisco, lives in L.A. with his fiance, I think it's Ngoc Nguyen, but I don't know. Looks like it's perhaps Laotian or Vietnamese, the name, and her family. And, again, go to Indie Media for more thoughts on that. There's some debate back and forth on it, and perhaps you can put your own thoughts on Indie Media after you've been to this Capitola Book Cafe event, which starts in half an hour. That's out at King's Plaza. I just learned the name of that center, which is at 41st and Capitola Road, and it's right next to the movie theater, if you know where the 41st Avenue movie theater is. So, now a little music, and I'll be back.
I could have been what I could have been. I could have been something. If what I could be had been left to be, I would have been something. A tower of strength, a center of power, at $10 an hour. I could have done a big thing, some luck to do. I wanted to, I would have done big things. Swam a few rivers, climbed a few hills, paid all my bills. Now it's just dreams that I'm stuck with. Hell, there ain't a lot to show. I haven't gone far from the starting line, but deep down inside where it counts, I know.
I know, I know, I know.
And if I could have gone where I could have gone, I could have gone.
I could have gone far,
far as I could see.
And that's one of my favorite numbers from working. It's If I Could Have Been. It's Free Radio you're tuned to. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. I'm going to play a little bit now of something I believe I began to play before, which is a report from actually a critic, someone who was not persuaded that, who had her doubts about the protest flyering that I and others were doing outside the coffee roasting company 3 or 4 weeks ago, supporting Street Minister Jerry Henry, who still faces, I think it's 11 charges for essentially trying to use public spaces against the wishes of merchants in Aptos at the Aptos Coffee Roasting Company, which is also owned by Colleen Crosby. And she was kind of considering our stuff, and she had some doubts and thoughts about it, but she also had some experiences with the police that she was talking about. I'm going to play a bit of that now. It's in the middle of an interview. It may seem a little bit... maybe a little bit difficult to pick up on, but let's see if we can do that.
Came up and he's like, the cop said, you know, it's a shame because the band members are always the ones that have to clean up. And my friend who was in the band was like, yeah, but that's all right. It's just not too many people danced. Ayla's the only one that danced here. And the cop looked at me and he said, oh, yeah, where's the pole? And I was just like, oh, my God. At that point, my boy...
Indicating that you were...
Indicating, like, I was just the sexual object and whatever, you know. Our conversation was very legit, very, you know...
Do you think he was oblivious to the impact? Do you think he regarded that as a compliment to you?
No, I think he was just... He was just not abusing his power, but just not realizing the impact that he had being an officer of uniform breaking up a party. Mm-hmm. And to make a statement like that to someone that you know or that you're friends with, you know, you might laugh it off. But because he was an officer of the law and he was there, you know, using his power to do something, that statement, you know, definitely took me off guard. Well, to make matters worse, I had a boyfriend at the time, and he came and, you know, walked me away. And when he heard what the officer said to me, he got very mad. And he's like, he said, what? And at that point, about 8 cops ran into the house and arrested my boyfriend for assault and battery against me.
Did he assault and batter you?
No, he didn't. And I said, I'm not pressing charges. Nothing happened. They're like, oh, well, we saw it, and we're taking him in. And I had to stay up all night and try to bail him out of jail. And it was. And this is just one case. I've gone through quite a few things like that with the cops in Santa Cruz. And it's they're just getting worse and worse. And I think there's a reason for it, because people are starting to rebel against our society, the way things are going with our government and everything, and they're scared. You know, I feel sorry for most cops.
Oh, slip of the tongue, eh?
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, they need to find a happy medium, you know? They need to involve the community more with the police and you know, understand. You know, I remember years ago when Happy got shot downtown. I was in high school, and I used to come and hang out with them and talk to them, and I don't know. I have to get going, but...
We've been talking with...
Ayla.
And Ayla, thank you for... spending a moment here.
No
well,
problem.
You'll be arrested in the morning.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So they're safing it up here. I'm talking with
Mike Metzger.
And Mike, you...
But before Mike, we have, I believe, a caller calling in. Hi, caller. You're on the air. Hello?
I'll try later.
Okay. All right. We're going to go back to Mike Metzger and whoever else calls in.
You have been to Kim Baskett, the ogre in the basement, the court referee, although
dungeon.
In the dungeon, on the basement of the county building. I always, by the way, recommend people disqualify by using a 170.6 CCP statement. What happened?
Went in for 2 separate charges. One was hacky sacking or taking over public space. That was the charge. And the other charge was a jaywalking ticket. And
where were you jaywalking?
On Pacific and Water. This has been months and months and months ago. Right down here.
And Pacific and Water.
So, they both added up to about $1,000 of fines. And
with failures to appear or without failures to appear?
For charges and failures to appear.
And did you pled? Were you informed by Baskin? Do you have the right to a jury trial on the failure script?
Yeah. I just want to get the shit over with pretty
did
much.
Did she tell you had the right to a jury trial?
She did tell me that, yes.
Trial or a jury trial?
A jury trial.
Amazing. Then I commend her because in the past she's not been so informing people. I'm glad she's learning. Failure to appear is a misdemeanor, which gives you a public defender and a jury trial if you want it. But you decided you were going to plead guilty and she gave you how many hours of community service?
151 hours plus a $75 initial fee.
For hacky sacking and jaywalking.
Yes, that's correct.
Are you feeling a little repentant finally, big boy?
Yeah, I guess I am.
Yeah, you're looking. Well, remember, this is a kind of a religious form of a test for you. If you can bear up under this, then eventually heaven will open her gates.
Yeah, thank you very much, man.
Yes. Uncle Dennis, you say you found your magic duct tape this morning? This is the duct tape that Ashcroft was recommending some years ago, or?
Probably not, yeah.
And actually, that's some interesting tape, but I know we've heard that before, and I kind of thought we would be getting into something else, and have to cue that up. When I was up in Berkeley about a week and a half ago, I ran into Duncan and Bottleneck, a couple of guys at a table in front of Cody's Books, which is a kind of a historic bookstore four blocks from the on the south side of the UCB campus on Telegraph Avenue. And they talked to me a bit, and some of it I discussed in a previous show. There's apparently been a crackdown on the free meal up there, or a worsening of the food situation. I'm going to play a little bit about that and then get back to you with perhaps something about our county housing element, which has been a subject of some controversy and some concern by activists like Linda LeMaster of Housing Now in Santa Cruz, which would require the county to actually provide for and encourage some low-income housing or even affordable housing, which isn't terribly low-income, but it's more than condos, I guess, or $800,000 homes. Well, here's a little bit from Berkeley first, though. About a year ago, the Berkeley Food and Housing Project announced that budget cuts were forcing them to shut down Quarter Meal, which had been serving a free dinner five nights a week for more than 30 years. What I'm doing here is I'm reading from a statement that these two are distributing on the street corner. This announcement received major press coverage, and the community responded by making special donations that allowed the meal to continue serving 3 days a week on Monday through Wednesday at its usual location at Trinity Methodist Church. On Thursdays and Fridays, a group of volunteers started serving a free dinner at People's Park, and many of the people who ate at it regularly felt that food was generally better and more plentiful there than at Quarter Meal. Even more important, there was always a feeling of mutual respect between the people serving the food and the people eating it, a feeling that had almost completely withered away at Quarter Meal over the course of the last 5 years. Quite a few people expressed the wish that Quarter Meal would shut down and let this People's Park meal expand to a full 5 days a week meal program. However, in early April of 2005, the Food Project announced that the Quarter Meal was going to resume serving 5 days a week, and the volunteers who had been serving the meal in People's Park decided to shut down rather than compete with Quarter Meal. Unfortunately, when Quarter Meal resumed operation on Thursday, April 14, 2005, the meal was nothing like the traditional Quarter Meal, which was always a substantial sit-down meal served in the Trinity Church dining hall and usually included an entree, rice or potatoes, cooked vegetables, salad, juice, or some similar drink, and a dessert. It was just a bag lunch handed to people out the door and had to be taken elsewhere for eating. This bag lunch, handed out on the 14th, contained a small styrofoam cup of beef stew, which had gone cold by the time most diners had a chance to eat it, one piece of bread, a tiny plastic container of pudding, an equally small serving of juice in a plastic bag, and an underripe orange. One diner saw it and joked, they ought to call this a 16th meal because it's only got about one-fourth of the food in a regular Quarter Meal in it.
It might be mentioned that for many years it always used to be that the Quarter Meal was a good place for people
B.D. Duncan speaking.
To have a congenial social time eating together.
I remember. Very vaguely. One of the main reasons this flyer continues, the Berkeley community rallied to save the Quarter Meal in 2004 through the publicity generated by the threatened closure was the information the community hadn't known previously. For example, the community learned that the majority of the people who eat at the Quarter Meal have been coming there almost every weekday for years and rely on it to provide them with their main meal of the day. A number of Quarter Meal attendees told reporters that they would regularly would remain very hungry if the quarter meal closed. Many regulars at Quarter Meal have just enough income from old age pensions, disability payments, county welfare, or low-paying jobs to pay their rent, but very little resources are left over for food. Others are working homeless people who have jobs but can't afford housing and live in cars or campers or camp out whenever and wherever they can find a place to do so. I should say whenever they can find a place, or wherever they can find a place. And some are people with drug, alcohol, or mental problems who will eat a square meal if they can just walk in and be served one free, but will remain constantly undernourished if they can't. The Food Project's present policy of substituting a snack for a square meal seems to punish people for learning how to cope reasonably well with poverty. Some people have speculated that the real intent is to intimidate the permanently poor into leaving Berkeley. A number of Bay Area communities have already done this. Isn't it time for the citizens of Berkeley to prove, as we have so many times in the past, that we have enough compassion and common sense to behave more humanely? Bring back the real quarter meal. Okay, with us now at the stand of Duncan is the... who are you, sir?
I'm the founder of the Cart Pushers Association. My name is Mark Donnell, a.k.a. Bottleneck.
So what should I call you, Mark, Bottleneck, or...
Call me Bottleneck, please.
All right. Then Bottleneck, you're a man who is you've been pushing cart pusher associations, or you used to push it?
I continue to push the cart pusher himself as a human being with a lot of dignity and respect in this community and across the nation and the world.
Now, we're talking about a shopping cart in which numerous houseless folks keep their stuff.
That's correct. A shopping cart can be used for many purposes. Recycling is one of the common purposes used, but also just for organizing someone's goods that may not have a house, may not have a car, may not have a place to live.
You might not be able to believe how hard he used to work for years and years recycling with a shopping cart. It was amazing. You're sort of like pushing uphill a 1,000-pound load on your shopping cart or something.
Well, that may be exaggerating slightly, but yes.
Hours with a 900-pound load of shopping cart stuff on your shopping cart. You know, I used to talk about
okay, that. It's about half that. We work about 5-6 hours a day and push a good 300 to 400 pounds daily to the redemption centers. I had a partner, Earl Griffith, who helped me in my recycling route. And we would work together to clean the recyclables and the trash at the same time off of the avenues in Berkeley and in West Oakland as we work toward the redemption center 6 days a week.
Could you make a living at this?
This was our living. In fact, this was my entire living income for about 8 years.
How much did you make, let's say, on average per day?
Well, it's pretty hard to estimate what an average would be, but I'd say about $2 an hour, maybe.
Wow. Low wages for hard work.
Well, that may be exaggerating the wages, as a matter of fact, because...
Very low wages for lots of work.
That's correct. Now you're talking.
Now, why have you abandoned this not-so-lucrative profession?
Well, actually, in my older age, I've stopped drinking, and that's one of the main factors in the fact that now I do gardening work. I'm able to work with a lot of different people and work doing gardening work, which I feel is equally important in the overall environmental picture of helping the earth produce.
Have other recyclers taken over the job that you had in the early 90s?
Certainly. There's just many, many recyclers that have taken the job over. In fact, I tend to counsel as many of them as I can. Last night I was able to help counsel one of the recyclers that I saw on the streets. And I can also help them with a few dollars now, where I, in the past, made so little wages and was so addicted to alcohol that I wasn't able to really bring out the benefits of the income that I am
and
able.
And yet you were organizing a union or association of cart pushers.
Oh, absolutely. We had a fantastic organization of cart pushers, the Cart Pushers Association Berkeley chapter.
How many people were there in this association?
Well, this organization in 92 was founded, and it really held together through 93 until... I have to admit I slipped back into a pattern of drug abuse and I did not pursue the organizational sides of the association.
What did it involve? How would you say that this, how many people were involved in this association?
Well, it was a loose-knit group and it wasn't just people that owned carts. It was people that actually felt the need to organize homeless people or poor people in the community. And our group varied. We had weekly meetings from maybe 10 to as many as 15 people who would show up for
the meeting. What would be discussed at your weekly meetings?
Well, we would discuss things like how to build cardboard condominiums, how to clothe yourself and house yourself at night. And you know, we would have how to produce a tent with a shopping cart and a tarp and keep your carts organized, how to recycle bottles and cans safely and effectively. In other words, by sorting, pre-sorting as you work your route, it helps organize your materials so that when you get to the redemption center, which is often a very chaotic adventure getting at the redemption center, we would be completely organized and have our bottles and cans completely sorted into bags where we would just dump them into containers, put them on the scale, and redeem our recyclables for cash.
Did you ever? Let me ask you, Bottleneck, what did any written material come out of this association?
Absolutely. We actually produced what was called the CPA newsletter, and that actually evolved into the shopping cart news, which shopping cart news had about 8 issues. Which
is it archived anywhere where people can read it or see it?
Richard List would be the man to find out. He seems to
Infamous poop art artist.
Yes,
plop art.
King of plop art.
Yes.
He has kept some of the materials from back in that era, which if anybody has them, it would be him.
Well, sort of like the 90s version of the 70s and 80s teletimes, although much more abbreviated, perhaps?
Maybe so. I can't comment on that.
You see, there was a lot more of this kind of creative and counterculture stuff going on. There were these different alternative underground publications, you know, that you just don't see it's being done, nearly as much anymore. Maybe some of it being done, but it used to be people knew about each other. Gypsy Katana long ago did something called the street scene. You know, different people did it. John Delmos, a street person, had his own paper. I think it was called something like Telegraph Hashbury. Time.
I believe we're ripe for that reoccurrence of that era of environmentalism and of cultural awareness, because people are getting fed up with the cell phones, they're getting fed up with the computers, they're getting fed up with the VCRs and DVDs and automobiles and SUVs. And people are now ripe and ready for a reemergence of the cultural blessings that were apparent back in the late 60s, early 70s. The free speech movement, the anti-war movement, we've got similar problems today. We've got Big Brother that wants everyone and has surveillance around the globe. We've got environmental problems that are tremendous. We've got war. We've got war going on now. All of the reasons that we united back then are very apparent in this culture that we have right now. People are ready to see something new, and I believe things like the teletimes and the shopping cart news can be revived, because I've seen a tremendous emergence of people's spirituality recently. People have finally decided that it's time for us to come together as human beings, and the spirit of the human being is going to grow, in my opinion.
Now, I know that Michael Diehl and others have sort of Berkeley Union of the Homeless or Homeless Union. I'm like, what's the name of the group that they're working with now?
Duncan,
do you know what they call the group?
I'm really not informed about it. I have taken a few photos of demonstrations. Often there would be demonstration groups at the Triangle. You know about the Triangle down there.
Block away from where we're standing in front of Cody's bookstore.
Big signs and things. There's some difference of opinion about it. Because, see, one person I know is pretty hip about the street said that Michael Diehl wants a great big area for a great many different homeless people and street people to sleep in the night. But this guy says often that's just what you often have when you have a big crowd. You have some people making a lot of trouble. And he favors more, not so much that sort of thing, as people forming personal individual relationships. Like, that's why he often lives. I do something for you, you do something for me. You know, so he's not really in favor of what he says. Michael Diehl's goal is to have a great big reserved area where a big mass of people could try to sleep together, because you would have a lot of trouble. There would be some rotten apples in the barrel who could spoil it for everybody else.
What do you say?
Well, my experience is the same as Duncan's. Anytime you get a whole lot of people sleeping together, you get what's called a lot of dealing going on. A lot of people come up there, and they think it's a place that you can deal drugs for 24 hours, and they use it as a spot which is not necessarily for sleeping. It makes it hard for people to sleep in a big community, and it makes it dangerous for people to have people that come along and the police come along. And
What about experiments like Dignity Village in Portland, Oregon, and Tent City 3 in Seattle? You've had your own tent cities here in Berkeley, right?
We may have, but I can't speak for other cities. See, I've been here in Berkeley for 13 years, homeless on the streets. And I am not an activist that travels from town to town. I ride a bicycle. I gave up my car 12 years ago. I believe that walking and riding a bicycle are the most purest ways to transport your body in this culture that we have, and that the automobile and the transit system that many people use to go from hippie village to other places in the country is often polluting the earth. Whereas I believe a local, think locally and act locally is my motto. I believe that you should think and act as locally as you can. Start with your neighbors. Work with the people that are right around you and close to you, and work with them with love and compassion, and it will grow from there. But having a global outlook that we can somehow change the world by utilizing the automobile, to me, is not a real serious
answer. Looking at the shopping cart situation now and the associations of homeless people, what are you feeling optimistic? Are you what kind of advice would you give to those groups, or have you given to those groups?
Well, I give the group advice to people that own cars. I say get rid of your cars. I say you don't need to own cars.
Right, but I'm talking to about homeless people who trying to do associations like you were doing in the early 90s.
Homeless people are open to new ideas. It's people that own a lot of property and things that aren't open to those ideas. Homeless people have always been open to speaking and talking, like we are right now. We're standing here, a group of people that basically are very low on the scale of American seniority, of American
cash assets.
Cash assets, for example. And we can sit here and speak sort of impromptu. We can speak on the spot. We can talk and we can stand here, whereas a person in a car, he's got a parking meter he's got to worry about, and he's got to worry about his mortgage payment, and he's got a job to do 8 to 5 daily. But a person that pushes a shopping cart on the street will stand and talk to you because he may not have to get to the redemption center by 4:15 p.m. that day. He probably has most of the day to organize his life and work towards his goal of making a little bit of money to keep him sustained with whatever needs he has. So shopping cart pushers and poor people on the street have a very, very close unity that other people in life cannot really understand. For example, we have homeless meals that we all go to, and we coalesce at those meals. We sit and we talk about issues that are important to us, whether it be health, government, whether it be the environment, or whether it just be fun and entertainment that we may be having. We can sit there every day, many times per day at different meals, and have a community, much like the communities were set up many years ago when people needed an alternative to a bar, and they produced lodges and fellowships around the community that help bring people together in the community to discuss issues that are important to them.
I'd just like to interject. I think this interview that started some time ago with me and Bottleneck and maybe some other people, it has some real value. I'm hoping to produce, I can't promise I will, I can't guarantee I will, I'm hoping to produce a new magazine called Blurts, in the sense of blurting things out. The subtitle would be a zine for free expression communication. I do have some money to get it Xeroxed or printed, but there's the whole thing of getting it all together, you know. But what I mean is, like, if you could send me a copy of this tape or a transcription, but that might be asking too much, I think I'd really be interested in putting this into the first issue of Blurts.
All right. Well, listen, we've been...
I'm giving you my mailing address. And,
right, and we'll be getting back to you on this, Duncan. For those who are interested, this entire interview is archived at www.huffsantacruz.org. The minute it's played on the air, so you will have access to it 24 hours a day. All you need to do is get to a computer and download it, and that's true for anybody listening. We have been talking again with...
Mark Bottleneck.
And with...
Vian Duncan.
And anything else? Anybody else want to say anything? Any comments? No? Okay. Well, thank you.
And that was an interview in Berkeley about a week or two ago with those two guys.
you can often find Duncan selling his own writing. He's a cartoonist. He's a writer. He's distributor of Street Spirit newspaper up there, and a friend of Claire Birch, who's a prolific author and video journalist on homeless issues, as well as other issues. You can find him at Haste and Telegraph, right in front of Cody's bookstore, if you're interested. Half a block away from that at the Med Cafe, you can find Julia Vinograd, a poet who has been on the air a number of times. And, in fact, I'm going to put on one of her poems right now. So there.
The Promised Land. All lands are promised, all promises are broken, but mine is different. When I was a child, I lived in a house, and the countries lived in a map, and the map lived in school, and I didn't like school. Countries hurt me when I forgot the dates of battles or spelled capital cities wrong, but when the school day ended, there were no countries, and we all played, shouting, laughing, and yes, already choosing sides. But I thought we were just playing. So much blood, and every day the losers dying on refugee marches and the flies, but all the documentaries begin to sound the same. All lands are promised, all promises are broken, but mine is different. When I was a child, the worst thing you could do with a cut was get dirt on it. I was warned firmly. First mother washed off the blood, then put on stingy stuff which hurt more than the cut, and then a Band-Aid, and... Now remember, keep that clean. Were the countless armies who shed blood for their chosen piece of dirt, for the land they loved, who got dirt in their blood till all their blood spilled on the dirt, were they just children who should have listened to their mothers? Go wash off that world, young man. Do you want to get infected? All lands are promised. All promises are broken. But mine is different. When I was a child, there was an ice cream store with cut glass dishes and a striped awning, and the man who ran it had red suspenders, put on double whipped cream and bowed when he served us. And I sometimes wished his shop would be attacked by television Indians so I could rescue it heroically and with as much blood as possible. Though Bobby next door laughed and said girls weren't allowed to rescue people. I'd still like to, a pistol blazing in each hand, though the shop's been replaced by a mall, and the owner moved away or died. In those days, it was the same thing. All lands are promised. All promises are broken. But mine is different. No one is innocent.
When I retired, the first 2 years I was downhearted. But then I give myself a good going over. Joe, I said, you can't sit at home like that, waste your time. You got to get out, do things. Well, the day goes pretty fast for me now. Keep busy, keep moving. That's the trick. You wake at 10, fold up the bed. You don't want to leave your couch open all day, you know? It's depressing. You cook an egg. You toast some bread. You cook for yourself, you save a bundle. You don't keep track of your money, who will? You think about the day ahead. You don't go feeling sorry for yourself. It's like I said, you can sit at home and be mad at the world, or you can get out and do things. You take a walk, you meet a chum. This one guy lives down by National Biscuit. Boy, you should see the nice aroma. You shoot the bull. You argue some, and maybe he calls up a couple of other fellas to come over and play some poker. You lose their chin until they come. This guy remembers what cards you picked up. The dirty bum, but even getting beat at gin sure beats doing nothing. You take a bus, you take a train, you go visit your wife's grave. On the way, you read the Reader's Digest. It does you good to use your brain. Or maybe you go out and see your cousin. You bring a six-pack. You take a stroll down memory lane. When we was young, we was always together. And raised in Kane, We go back a long ways, him and me. All the times we had. I remember once, back in 22, we was at this fair with these girls we knew. On this crazy ride, where you screamed or you prayed, the Big Dipper they called it. We could hardly walk as we left the car, so we staggered down for a candy bar. Then we sat and laughed in the penny arcade. At 6 o'clock, you watch the news. Them politicians get you so mad you throw your slippers at the set. You cook some franks, no big to-dos. Most nights you lay around and straighten up. Maybe you call your daughter. You watch a game, you take a snooze. But then there's Sunday. Sunday's different. You change your shirt and shine your shoes, 'cause you're going around the block to the tavern. You shoot some pool, you drink some beer. You don't have to drink a lot to have a good time. You have maybe 3-4 in an evening. You find a pal, you bend his ear. You meet a lot of your old crowd there Sunday. Sometimes a bunch of you, you sing the kind of song you never hear, like your Pretty Baby and Tifa too. And then you cheer. Last Sunday night we sang Till We Meet Again. Believe it or not, I once did a waltz to that tune. Honest to God, it was at a dance. I was 17, and the girl was like from a magazine, and the lights were low, and I really mean low. I think a couple of my friends had something to do with that. And I kissed her cheek as we waltzed away. I remember that like it's yesterday. Boy, was she surprised. I can hear her say, Joe. They drive you home from round the block. You take your cash out of your sock. You fix the bed, you check the lock. You wind the clock. When I retired, a lot of people told me, Joe, you got your health, you shouldn't have done it. But I got no regrets. I keep busy, keep traveling. I go to fires every once in a while. That big fire we had on Milwaukee Avenue about 3 months ago, I was there. I was surprised. The smoke was coming out of there heavy as hell, but you don't see no flame, you know. Boy, that was some fire.
And you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org if you are listening to our stream. I'm Robert Norse. This is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. And you can call in if you'd like. Call in line is 427-3772. As promised, by the way, that was working, a selection from the musical called Joe. As promised, I'm going to be playing now some selections from the Planning Commission hearing on the fifth floor of the county building a couple of weeks ago. And it's somewhat self-explanatory. It was an attempt by some service providers and some folks concerned about affordable housing to get the county, it's kind of an impossible job, the Board of Supervisors, to follow the law so there can be some actual funding coming to the county, which has been cut off because they don't have the adequate housing element. In fact, they're being sued on that issue. And when the Board of Supervisors proceeded anyway, a local judge, to the surprise of some of us, I think it was Judge Danner, ruled that they had to go redo some hearings because the public had not been given adequate notice. And so now they're doing a kind of a pro forma, and did a pro forma rubber stamping of the housing element, which I think passed with very few changes. But here's some of the process, which gives you some insight into what the situation is in the county. Again, the county is a much broader area than the city, which has about 55,000 people. The county has, what, 225,000, 250,000 people. Here's some of that discussion.
Okay, well, it's about 10:15 on May 25th, 2005. I'm up here on the fifth floor of the county building. in front of the currently empty Board of Supervisors chambers. We're waiting for the Planning Commission, that's the County Planning Commission, to return from its closed session. And with us is...
My name is Scott Beasley.
And Scott, why are you here?
I'm an advocate for housing for people with developmental disabilities, and I would like to see some changes happening in the housing element to be able to create more affordable housing within the county itself. At this point in time, we're creating the majority of our housing for folks of above moderate income levels, and that does not meet the needs of people with developmental disabilities whose interests I serve.
Or even the needs perhaps of a majority of people in the county who perhaps aren't of or are working class people. Do you have any sense of the stats in the county on that issue?
I don't know about working class folks. I do know that in looking at the information that's been put out regarding the housing element and the process, that since January of 2000 up to October of 2004, the housing that was supposed to be created to serve folks of very low to moderate income was somewhere in the neighborhood of around 61%. And actually, what's been created is only about 41% of the housing that has been developed during that time period is serving people of less than moderate income.
I just came from a meeting of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, which is concerned about civil rights for poor people and also services. We kind of wander from the city to the county. But what's the situation in terms of the number of people you think who are unserved or unhoused in the county? Do you have any sense of that?
I don't. I don't deal with homeless issues at all.
But of course, there's obviously a link because disabled people or people with disabilities who can't get into housing may end up homeless, right?
Generally, what happens is they're housed in group homes or end up remaining with parents or other family members, and the people that I support are looking for independent living circumstances. And so the issue is to create enough affordable housing to allow people, adults, to be able to live in an independent situation. If you can imagine what it would be like to continue to live with your parents, for example, until you were 50, 60 years old, or what it might be like to live in housing that you didn't necessarily get to choose your roommates, etc. For a lot of people, that's a big source of frustration. And so what we are trying to do is to meet the need of people with developmental disabilities to ensure that they have housing provided that would allow them to live independently.
How many people would you say are impacted here by the current housing element, and what's the fall and the gap between the housing units that are needed and the housing units available?
In my personal opinion, the issue is about density and simply the low density levels that we have here in the county don't allow for more construction of affordable housing, and there is no incentive for nonprofits and affordable housing advocates to build more housing because they can't do it at a density level that allows them to sustain themselves. So the issue is that we have to increase the allowable density level within the county.
What's the current density level, and what are you looking to increase it to?
The highest is 17.4 units per acre. I'd like to see it moved at least to 27 units per acre.
And what impact would that have on the number of units that would be available then, let's say, in a year or two?
Well, the opportunity would be there for the construction industry to be able to provide that housing for the folks that we're talking about and for the general population.
It's like the Planning Commission is back, and you're going to have an opportunity to present your thoughts.
I will indeed.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll be talking with
Scott Beasley.
Of?
I'm a housing advocate for people with developmental disabilities.
Thanks, Scott.
Talking with Gretchen Regenhardt.
Gretchen, you are an attorney who's concerned about this issue.
Yes, we're actually suing the county over its failure to adopt a housing element on time.
That sounds serious. Why would you? You're spending money and time to sue the county. It sounds like there's a significant impact here. What's the reason for this?
Well, the reason is that the county's housing policies have failed to provide adequate housing for low-income people for a long period of time. The county hasn't had a certified housing element since 1985.
What's the impact been for poor and low-income? And because those are the people I work with, but it probably affects more people beyond that.
Well, the impact is that there's no money. The county doesn't qualify for a lot of the money that would be available to assist in the construction of lower-income housing because it doesn't have a certified housing element. Also, the county's densities are so low that developers are discouraged from building housing that might be affordable, like apartments, housing of that type.
So today there's a Planning Commission hearing. What issues are you going to bring up?
Well, I'm going to ask the Planning Commission to, I'm going to raise some issues about the inadequacy of the plan that's been proposed, including a failure to have any sites for emergency shelters, a failure to have sites for farm worker housing, and the overall failure to have sites zoned at adequate densities to allow development of housing that would suit low-income people. And I'm going to ask the Planning Commission to send it back to the Planning Department to fix it before it goes to the board to get adopted.
Is that likely?
I don't think so. Historically, the Planning Commission has generally just sent the element up to the board and without any recommendations.
You already had one success. Judge Danner has forced this kind of reexamination, a reopening of the housing element discussion.
Judge Danner ruled that the county failed to properly adopt the housing element when it took that action in January, that it wasn't a proper adoption because the county had bypassed the Planning Commission and the public hearing process at the time it adopted the element.
But is this, you're suggesting that even if that's true, this is still largely a token process where the Planning Commission is going to rubber stamp it anyway?
Well, I hope not this time. I think perhaps Judge Danner's ruling will encourage the Planning Commission to take its role seriously and realize how important it is and that it's an opportunity to improve the housing element rather than just pass it on.
There are other elements than the fact that there was not adequate public comment time provided. You're actually concerned with actual elements. You took that issue to Judge Danner to rule on as well, right? The actual substance of the housing element was in question.
Well, this lawsuit was brought because the county's original housing element was due in December of 2003, and here we are in 2005 without an adopted element. So we weren't attacking the substance itself. We were attacking the failure of the county to do it, to do the process.
How much money has the county lost in terms of grants as a consequence of their not adopting such an element?
You know, I don't know the exact...
Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, tens of millions.
I'd say potentially hundreds of thousands, at least. I don't know.
Well, but this is a Board of Supervisors that, you know, likes money. Why wouldn't they adopt an element? What's your analysis?
The board has been... I think initially the reason was that the board thought it was protecting the environment by keeping densities low. Mm-hmm. I think that's an outdated analysis, and somehow the board hasn't caught up with that at this point. I don't know why there's such a reticence to increase densities to allow for affordable housing development.
So that's the issue, that they have to increase density in order to adopt any kind of housing element that's acceptable at the state level?
Well, what state law requires is that if there are not adequate sites zoned with infrastructure and available services to accommodate the need that the state has designated as and the local association of governments has designated as the suitable amount, then the county must have a program to allow multifamily development by right. So the county doesn't have enough sites to accommodate the need for lower income housing because of its zoning, because of the low densities. As a result, the county should have a program that allows anybody to do multifamily housing by right without going through a lot of
rigmarole,
public hearing processes and things like that would allow the NIMBYs to come in and stop the project. Mm-hmm. The county doesn't have a program like that. What it has in this most recent revision is an overlay district, which they're calling a program of that type. But this overlay district just places a potential zoning designation on properties that are already zoned for some other use. So it allows them, in addition to developing in accordance with that existing use, to also develop affordable housing. But there's a number of reasons why we don't think that program is adequate. First of all, because it is an overlay and it allows the owner to use it for the other purpose. Secondly, because it won't actually be fully developed until with sites set aside for that purpose until December of 2006. And finally, because it's not a by right program, it allows all these sites are going to be designated as CEQA projects and be subject to CEQA review, which could reduce densities and make it impossible to develop for affordable housing.
CEQA review, for those who don't know, is?
California Environmental Quality Act, which requires a complete analysis of traffic impacts, environmental impacts, and so forth, of every project, and determinations whether those impacts can be mitigated.
When was the last low-income housing project that was actually built in the county that you're aware of?
Well, there was a project built not long ago in Freedom called Corlittis Creek.
Thank you. Talking with?
Gretchen Regenhardt.
Thanks.
And more from this in just a moment, but a brief musical break.
Summies don't care when they put down the plate. There's a sound, not with grace. When they move a chair, it'll scrape with a grate on the ground.
Not with me.
I will have my hand right when I place the glass. Notice how I stand right as customers pass. Serve a demi-tasse with a gesture so gentle, or do it again till it's near oriental. Be a fine waitress to see that you pleasure each guest. There's a twist to my wrist if I let a fork drop or cut up a pork chop or serve a New York chop. It all needs to be stylish and smart. That's what makes it an art.
And now, in the closing moments of the show, again, some information from the Planning Commission itself, actually testimony before the Planning Commission urging them to take some significant action to change the element. They did not, nor did the Board of Supervisors, but this is what the public had to say, or some of us.
My name is Gretchen Regenhardt. I'm an attorney with California Rural Legal System, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. I think many of you are aware that there's a lawsuit pending against the county for failure to adopt the housing element timely. As recently, the court ruled that the county had not properly adopted the housing element in January because the county had not sent the document here to the Planning Commission for review and recommendation and to take public comment. In doing that, the court recognized the importance of what the Planning Commission does and of giving more expertise.
But unfortunately, that's a little too hard to listen to. My apologies. I thought it was better quality. That's what happens when you record at one-third speed at too great a distance from the speaker. Hopefully I will learn from that or maybe take the advice of other free radio broadcasters and actually get some kind of audio disc recorder instead of my trusty but much battered and recently confiscated Panasonic handheld audio recorder. That's the one Lieutenant Clark took from me on Tuesday after removing the tape, which I would have liked to have played, and hopefully in some future time we'll play it. Actually, it's interesting. Lieutenant Clark ran into me later outside the City Hall, way outside the City Hall, since he told me that I couldn't go back in the City Hall and would be arrested if I were in the courtyard area or any place like that after my arrest on Tuesday. Arrested again, this time sent to jail until court. Again, probably not a true statement. I probably been sent to jail until I was bailed out later that night. Lieutenant Clark is not always accurate in his assessments and often uses them, I find, to intimidate or belittle people he's concerned with doing that to. But what he said to me after I returned from being held in handcuffs and being roughed up somewhat by him was, hey, Robert, your tape is blank, is what he told me. So I don't think so. I think that Lieutenant Clark is having a little fun with me in his own somewhat sadistic way. But hopefully that tape will be available to play on free radio. The issue of police abuse is an important one. I really covered a lot. I try not to exaggerate it, and I try not to I try to be as specific as I can about it and encourage those who are making complaints about it to do the same. And also, I encourage people not to get personal about it. On the other hand, it's important to hold people, particularly people in positions of authority, like Lieutenant Clark, who's a lieutenant, after all, accountable. Lieutenant Clark has a history, and admittedly, I've seen the dark side, and perhaps not enough of the light side, but I've seen a lot of the dark side of Lieutenant Clark. When he was Officer Clark in 1988, he used to kick homeless people awake, or even as they sat on the street, and he acquired the name The Kicker. He drew his gun on skateboarders in front of the old bookshop Santa Cruz and said to them, "Down on your knees and say your prayers," according to their accounts. I published these accounts in a publication which is in the library called The Street Shit Sheet, which is a homeless newsletter I wrote. Actually, 162 issues of it comes out now very infrequently, almost once a year. But you can read that. Clark, when he read this, stormed over to me and told me he was going to sue me for everything I had. Of course, no such lawsuit ever materialized. He's also known for such things as compiling a political dossier on Citizens Police Review Board member John Malkin when there was a Citizens Police Review Board. Malkin is also a free radio broadcaster and spoke with me about that at some length at different points. He also spoke about that issue Malkin did in the film To Serve and Protect, which is a very good film, by the way, which would be nice. We could post that one on the Huff website. Maybe we can at some point. It was made by two UCSC students about police misconduct in Santa Cruz. Covered the Happy John Dine killing in some detail. Lieutenant Clark, I've run into him at various times. In 1998, he falsely informed a panhandler that he couldn't panhandle using kind of disparaging language. Minor things, but that show a kind of an attitude which in a higher ranked officer really smacked me as inappropriate. It struck me as inappropriate. Maybe he smacked me too, but no. Sorry, I got to say, Lieutenant Clark has never hit me. He's never punched me. He did engage in the kind of pain compliance hold that was completely inappropriate prior to an arrest, and that's going to be the basis of any subsequent dispute I have with him and the city, probably, as well as the arrest itself at City Council on Tuesday, for trying to talk like every other person for 2 minutes at the public mic on the issue of the union IATSE that it was trying to secure its rights in what was apparently kind of a hastily raised issue. It was not one that I was really aware of until I got there. Anyway, Clark also is most notorious for another situation when a homeless man, D-Bob, hung himself near the county building, and the committee for the investigation of the camping ordinance, headed by then-Mayor Catherine Byers, was studying modifications in the camping ban. We all had some hopes there actually would be some real action at that time because there had just been three new council members elected. And they, instead of taking action over the winter, they appointed this commission. But the commission was hearing testimony. Then Sergeant Clark, I believe he wasn't a lieutenant at that time, commented, and I guess publicly, not just to the commission, but he may have done it also to the newspapers, that D-Bob's suicide was an autoerotic death. And the coroner later confirmed that that was absolute nonsense. So in essence, the sergeant was smearing a homeless man who had committed suicide, trying to make light of what happened, to trivialize it, or to make it appear something, I don't know, hedonistic or bizarre or prurient. And I've seen this continuing attitude, and I saw the attitude on Tuesday when Lieutenant Clark arrested me. It just hadn't changed. And I told him when he arrested me that I thought to some extent he'd grown in office. I mean, he wasn't throwing me down to the floor. He was just inflicting a lot of unnecessary pain and refusing to do me the courtesy or actually to properly fulfill his function to say that I was under arrest if I was. He didn't do that. But since he has the connivance of the city council with this, where they turn off the cameras and the public can't see it, and there were a few members of the, I mean, there, the public didn't seem too disturbed about it, I got to say. I watched some of the rest of the videotape, and the public went right on with its discussion, and Mayor Rutkin just sort of smiled, and away they went. So it was hardly a blip on the radar screen. But apparently one person was concerned, and he did speak up about the issue later publicly and talked to me and has offered to be a witness. And I do appreciate that. And if anybody has seen or was a witness to any of this stuff, and I suspect most of my regular listeners weren't, this was the afternoon session of the Tuesday City Council. It happened around between 5 and 5:30 on Tuesday afternoon. Please give me a call at 423-4833, the Huff Line, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. That's the group I work with. And also, if you've had experiences yourself, either with Lieutenant Clark or with other officers that you feel has been abusive, we need to hold officers publicly accountable. We have a right and, in fact, a responsibility to do that. And that's the only way that things change, if they change at all. And I understand some of the pessimism of some of the callers, or at least the caller who called in before, Ed. It's justified, you know, that an individual who kicks homeless people on the street can rise to lieutenant in this police force is a sad commentary. So I don't know. I mean, I'm taking a certain amount of time to diss Lieutenant Clark. I feel to accurately at least tell you the dark side of his record. If people want to call in and talk about his positive activities, please. You'll be given ample time. And if Lieutenant Clark himself wishes to appear on the show and talk about these issues, he's welcome to do that. I don't think that's going to happen. That's about it for Bathrop's Pier's Broadsides. I want to thank you for hanging with me. I'm going to start to make prep to leave. And I'll be coming back on Sunday at 9:30 in the morning. And if you have anything you want to put on the air yourself, you can either contact me beforehand at 423-HUFF. You may want to be a guest, or you may have somebody you recommend being a guest, 423-4833. Or you can call in during the show at that time. And I remind you, these shows are archived at www.huffsantacruz.org. There's going to be a usual Peace Friday demonstration happening between 4:30 and 6, either on the Brands 40 overpass or at Ocean and Water Streets. And as you heard earlier, there is a lecture by Aaron Glantz, which is in progress now at the Capitola Book Cafe. Probably will still be going on for another hour or so, including the chatting time afterwards. So you can check that out if you're interested. So thank you for being with me on this edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides. And if you decide to get arrested at City Council, please have the foresight to have somebody with a video camera and a number of people there. It's a very good idea. Thanks.
Breaker number 9, big buddy, put your ears on for me now. Big trucker got to have a bigger line. So come on, brother trucker, you got to come back, mother. Keep seeing double, lest I close one. I got to roll, 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 rough trucker. Short up ashamed by the shape I'm in. Roll, 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 rough trucker. I'm back on my wheels again. I'm running out of ways. Goddamn them headlights. Boy, I was sleeping the last two nights. But I'm gonna be alright. About halfway home. Can't get to the telephone. I'm hot as a pistol, dry as a bone. Now wonder if my baby's alone. I got to roll, roll, roll. Again. Roll, 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 sucker. Turn it around.
I've heard a lot of songs say, where you going, my son? Now I know they're true. Boy, you never stop to think how fast the years run. Now they've taken you. I remember you was 3 and a half. Your ma and me would sit there after things got quieted. We'd laugh at some new word you said. I'd tell you where to get to bed, and we'd plan the night away, planning for our kid. I was your hero then. I couldn't do no wrong as far as you were concerned. You thought I was the best of men. The tables hadn't turned. You hadn't learned how little time it takes. And daddies make mistakes. Seems to me that lately I've been thinking a lot. I think about my dad. Lots of funny things come back I thought I'd forgot. Now they make me sad. High school and it used to be, I didn't want him touching me, and I shuddered if he did. Further back to summer nights, baseball games beneath the lights, and sleeping in the car, my daddy and his kid. He was my hero then. He couldn't do no wrong as far as I was concerned. I thought he was the wisest and the strongest and the best of men. The tables hadn't turned. I hadn't learned how little time it takes. And everybody breaks. And daddies make mistakes. I've heard a lot of songs say, where you going, my son? Now I know they're for real. Boy, you never stop to think how fast the years run and the things they steal. Now it seems I always knew why I do the things I do and the things I never did.
And you are listening to From the Cream to the Dregs, a weekly exploration of the music of the 60s and the 70s. I'm Uncle Dennis. Be here till 11. We're going to be playing more music like Deep Purple and Black Sabbath.